This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
So much has happened today, that, and I'm really excited. Are you?
Oh, Anne? Totally. You know, especially when I catch that infectious tone in your voice.
Yeah, like, I know.
My word. Yeah.
Do I sound sleepy or what?
You sound a bit stuffed up, though. What's going on over there?
I think it's the air conditioning.
Ah,
okay. The air conditioning back home and the air conditioning in the office.
All right. Well, but on, buddy.
But I expect everything to clear up. And be smooth sailing for the rest of the morning.
Likewise.
Ah, okay. So you actually are on The Breakfast Grill today, and you speak to Chia Siang Ti. He's the CEO of Eversafe Rubber Berhad.
That's right. So Eversafe Rubber is involved in the tire retreading industry. Dare I put you on the spot here, Sharad? Care to explain?
Threading?
I
imagine when you get a new tire, it's got threads, thing that keeps a grip between the tire and the road. And with time, those threads diminish. So those grooves go, basically, and your tire gets kind of bald. And I imagine that what happens is those tires are taken, instead of discarded, they're given new life by having those threads put back into them. And I'm not quite sure how it's done.
Right.
But I imagine that's what we mean when we say rethreading.
Pretty good. Well done. Well, it is actually retreading without an H.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not like thread.
Yeah, you know? No. Well, it's called retreading. Well, at least, when you just Google it and that's what comes up. They are involved in the tire retreading. But this is a rather timely grill because they will be listing on the Bursa Malaysia tomorrow, or specifically on the ACE market tomorrow. And so already its public portion of its intended share sale has been oversubscribed by 65 times. So it looks like there's plenty of demand for Eversafe Rubber shares.
Well, you know, of course, Julian and us, we've had discussions about these huge oversubscribed shares going, when they get listed. And he says often a problem of pricing, that they're not priced adequately. And that's been an interesting conversation that we've come back to on several occasions.
Right.
And I guess that's going to be one of the questions you ask.
Not quite, but nevertheless, Eversafe Rubber is going to be looking to raise about 17 million ringgit. Whether that was priced correctly or not, I think they're pretty happy with that figure. So it'd be interesting to see what their plans are for those 17 million ringgit. Now, I know a big part of it is that they're looking to expand, how about this, into South America, I don't think, again, I'm making assumptions here, I don't think there's a large presence of Malaysian companies on the South American continent, but, here we've got Eversafe Rubber, who have already said, they plan to expand their presence in South America. When you consider the size of Brazil's economy, I mean, granted, they've been going through a bit of a rough patch of late, but, the potential, just in terms of size is certainly there. So it'd be interesting to see what kind of value proposition, the likes of Eversafe Rubber would offer to Brazilian and South American customers.
Okay, what I'm doing, Han? I'm looking up the retreading process.
Nice.
And I have all these wonderful images before me of a bald tire and how this other layer is like hair bonding, I guess. It's like they place the threads back onto a new set of threads onto the old tire. So the old tire is kind of a base, and they must have some sort of adhesive that goes onto the old tire.
Wow, we're getting so technical now. But then,
because it's just fascinating. Because I was wondering, can they do? I mean, can they really cut new grooves into the old tire? But clearly they're not doing that.
Well, I think with the Breakfast Grill, we won't be getting so technical. But when you do mention retreaded tires, though, I think one of the most immediate reactions is one of concern. Because generally there is this feeling of caution when it comes to the usage of retreaded tires. You even have got comments from Malaysia's Transport Ministry that talks about how some illegal retreaded tires are can be fatal, right? So we're going to be addressing those concerns, and how does Eversafe Rubber go about, pushing back against those kind of negative connotations when it comes to their industry.
Okay, just a matter of language here. When I mistakenly said thread, I'm kind of thinking about needle and thread. Actually, the tread is one of the definitions is the top surface of a step or a stair. So you can imagine where that would come from in terms of language.
Yeah.
Fascinating stuff.
I don't hold you against that.
Yeah. And it's not like it's only 5 minutes past six in the morning. We've learned something new. I wanted to ask you, what is the ACE market? For somebody who doesn't know much about, you know, the stock market, or I guess the main board, but what is this?
Yeah, so you've got the main market, you know, which has a few hundred players in there. And then you've got the smaller version, the smallest sub-market, which is called the ACE market there. Yeah.
Okay. So, I've learned so much, and it's still only six minutes past.
Well done. This is what happens on the morning run on BFM 89.9.
Okay, now we sound like we're mocking ourselves. On current affairs, which happens after the 8:30 bulletin, we take a look at Jakarta's gubernatorial elections. Ended yesterday with, in some sense, not a surprising defeat for the incumbent, Ahok, because of the kind of campaign that was run, and also some of the poll numbers that suggested that he really had a hard slog. It's been touted in some of the global media, the international media, as a win for extremism and for racial and religious baiting against the possibilities that Indonesia was focused on performance. And, you know, and so, you know, in yesterday's discussion, we talked about polls where Jakartans say that, Ahok had done a good job. Some at about 66% were saying that he'd done a good job, but they wouldn't necessarily vote for him because he didn't share the same religious affiliation. So religious affiliation trumped performance, which is fascinating because I think it has resonance all over the region. And what happens when you have a voting population that focuses on affiliation rather than performance?
And now going back to something you said earlier, you know, whereby this may not be such a shock given the kind of campaigning that was done in the lead up to this vote. And as I understand, this is actually the second round of voting because there was basically deadlock, right? In February, I believe, right? So, you know, but then when I read some other news articles, like from Reuters, for example, they actually include some social media reaction likening this result to, you know, what they saw in the US with Donald Trump's victory and also Brexit, in a sense that, you know, Ahok's popularity, you know, was, you would think that would be enough to tide him over for this vote. But, you know, obviously there have been some netizens within Jakarta who think otherwise. So, you know, Reuters sought to highlight that as well.
Yeah, I think analysts are split. Some are saying that his policies weren't popular, especially with the urban poor. But I'm that's what I'm looking forward to in terms of trying to understand. Are we overstating the religious and racial dimension of the campaign? It tended to get a lot of coverage because the winner, Anies Baswedan, who apparently isn't a respected academic and former university rector and seen as a moderate.
Former education minister as well.
Yeah, and he courted extremist groups like Front Pembela Islam. And so he's now saying he wants to be a governor for all Jakartans, regardless of who they voted for or regardless of their religious or ethnic affiliations. But having courted the extreme right-wing Islamist groups like Front Pembela Islam, what is he going to have to give them now that he's come to power? And I think that's always worrying. So he might have used the low road to get to power by, riding the tiger, as it were. But, you know, at some point, the tiger wants some payback. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the questions I'm going to be asking our analysts who's coming on after the 8:30
And
news.
That's for current affairs, right? And we'll also be exploring the same event during the 7:35 segment. But we'll be taking a more market, economics and investment approach. Because, you know, if you look at the incumbent, Ahok, he pretty much won favor among the international business community, like the foreign business community, due to his push in infrastructure projects. You know, he was trying to make bureaucracy really efficient. You know, so he had that going for him, at least in the eyes of the foreign business community. But as we now know, at least according to early polls, official results won't be out till next month, but early polls...
He's already conceded defeat.
Oh, he's already? Okay,
oh, yeah, he conceded defeat. And in fact, Anas Baswedan also made an acceptance speech. So I think the count is, it's good as done. It's not, wasn't a close call at all. I think, you know, in the high 50s for Anas Baswedan and his co-runner, and in the low 40s for Ahok. So, but yeah, absolutely. I think there is going to be some consequence. I wonder if after everything settles down, foreign investors, because they're notoriously cynical and pragmatic, they will say, well, you know, this is the new guy and we'll work with him, whatever it is.
Yeah, you know, it'd be interesting to find out what kind of policies or what kind of policy platform the incoming Jakarta governor will have, you know, as opposed to what Ahok had been running on and what he had been implementing over the last couple of years. Now, I think this is interesting as well because many analysts look at the result from this Jakarta election as a barometer of how Indonesia's presidential elections will fare in 2019.
Yeah, because in fact, in some ways, it was a bit of a proxy war. But backing Anas Baswedan was the loser in the last presidential election, Prabowo Subianto, of course, the son-in-law of the general, of General Suharto, the strongman of Indonesia, who ruled for decades, and backing Ahok was the current president, Joko Widodo, or Jokowi as he's affectionately known. So, yes, rehearsal for 2019, some people say. And others, and I'm watching the BBC World Service yesterday, are saying that now this is basically going to be the template for also how other parties conduct themselves. Basically, you take the low road, you incite racial hatred, you incite religious hatred, and that's how you win a poll.
Well, low road is subjective, right? But,
yeah. Well, I don't know if it's subjective. I think you can some, there's some clear criterion for the kind of engagement. So you either engage in the question on the level of policy, or you engage on the question of the person's personality. And if it's got to do with things that not about his, you know, his corruptibility, or you know, or some criminal trait or some personal flaw, but about something that he can't change about himself, his religious, well, you can change your religious affiliation. Perhaps you can't change your ethnic affiliation. And that's clearly a sign of the low road.
But obviously for Anies's supporters, you know, that is not the case, right? Because like you mentioned, they were obviously voting for the person, not the policy, right? So I guess it depends on, you know,
they were voting against Ahok. So the campaign saying, well, we cannot trust minorities. And so, you know, the idea that this will be the template for Indonesian politics, you know, to not trust the minority, not trust somebody, not to give somebody who's had a clear track record in terms of performance any credit because it's completely discounted because of their ethnic and religious affiliation.
No, sure, I totally get that point, but, you know, I wonder if we can expand that discussion to include, you know, whether voters vote for people like that or for candidates like themselves.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Yeah, and it's been said that, but, you know, when you look at Trump, if the working class is voting for a billionaire, what is the like themselves in it? Is it because their speech? Is it the way they talk about the world?
Right.
I mean, you know.
What kind of values they espouse?
Yeah,
right? You know,
I mean.
No, yeah. And no, don't get me wrong. No, I would like to, in an ideal world where every democracy out there in the world and every voter that's going to the polls would vote on policy. And, you know, I even dare say this. You know, I wish Malaysia would also, you know, start veering in that direction as well. No, I mean, okay, to be fair, we have. But, you know, make more gains in terms of voting on policy as opposed to the person.
Well, or prejudice. Or, you know, the idea of, you know, like affiliation, the presumption that if you are like me, you definitely are going to protect my interests. I mean, and that is the basis of racial politics, you know. So fascinating stuff. Also, quickly in the news, a large asteroid the size of the Rock of Gibraltar passed safely by Earth. And I love this kind of news. I mean, don't you? I mean, doesn't it remind you that we live on a planet that circles the sun, that's part of the solar system and part of this huge thing called the universe?
I'm just going to use a pop culture reference and think of the movie Armageddon and, you know, that lovely song, "Don't want to close my eyes."
No, I don't. No. Let's stop. Stop
sure,
him.
Come
stop
on.
Him. Turn off his mic.
Dude.
You know, so...
It just gets lost
I know
on
what
you,
man.
You're wrong crowd, you know, wrong crowd.
You know, you're thinking something that, and there's a clear scientific explanation why it's actually very difficult for those kind of objects, you know, asteroids and everything, to actually penetrate the Earth's atmosphere and hit planet Earth. Because if a rock of this size did hit planet Earth, it would be quite devastating
right.
for a large part of the planet. So, but anyway, that's part of it. We'll also come back. There's a lot of stories in the news about fake news. And we're going to take those things up after this at BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, The Morning Run continues. Tan Chung Han and myself, Sharad Kutin. And that was Heartbreak Road by Bill Withers. A smooth, smooth voice, that one. I love his Ain't No Sunshine. And I was just looking him up. He's now 78 years
wow.
old. A brilliant musician. We left off looking at some Malaysian news. And in fact, I've got the papers in front of me, Hannah. One of the most, I think, troubling headlines this morning. There it is, TB outbreak in Perak School, and that's in the Malay Mail. That's actually grabbing my attention this week. And, you know, TB, you think of a disease from the 1950s and 1960s. Why it's come back, why this school in particular was hit, and where else is TB in the country? I think, you know, I'm now going to be saying, in fact, when I looked at the news yesterday on Twitter about TB, I was thinking to myself, okay, do we know why TB is making a comeback, and or is this completely an isolated case?
Yeah, you know, because at the same time, you would think that, you know, with our vaccination programs in place in Malaysia, you know, TB wouldn't be featuring so prominently by the fact that there is this outbreak. I mean, that's the word that they use in the front page, right? Outbreak?
Okay, yeah, it does say outbreak.
Yeah.
Apparently, as you say, you know, most of us get these TB inoculation right. thing going when we're children.
Right.
But some kids are not immunized, and they're not immunized because parents don't want them
to be
immunized. It's one of these I don't know if this is true, and I'm holding judgment. But you know, we have that whole anti-vaccine vaccination movement. I don't know if you can call it a movement, and it's fascinating for that respect. You know, that in fact that parents do this to their children. You know, based on mistaken notions about the provenance of the medication and such, you know, so
yeah.
say that they might have bovine or porcine sources, and so you don't want to use it.
But it's really tragic.
Or making your kids autistic or something.
Right. Yeah. You know, but it's really tragic, you know, like, once again, if these, perspectives are misguided, you know, but it's really tragic that, you know, it does result in death, you know, because apparently the state of Perak alone has recorded 7 deaths since January, you know, because of...
From TB.
From TB, apparently. Well, that's, you know, what it says here on the front page of the Malay Mail. Right? So, you know, again, you know, I understand where they're coming from because they want the best for their children and, you know, wanting them to, you know, adhere to certain values that they espouse. Now, I get that, but when you see, you know, that it comes at the cost of a life.
Well, so
7 lives.
So, okay, so let's say you don't want to take this decision out of the hands of parents. You want parents not to be bullied, if you want, in air quotes, by the state. But the problem is, and some of the issues around vaccination, the process or the dynamics of vaccination suggests that it's not just your individual responsibility. You have a responsibility to the community.
Right.
Because what happens is that with this process is you need what they call herd immunity. And so a critical mass of people need to be immunized for everybody in some sense to be saved or insulated from infection. And so when people opt out, they actually threaten not just themselves and their children, but they threaten everybody else.
Right, exactly. You know, and you know, generally speaking, and if I may get personal here, real quick, you know, I am a big proponent of, you know, personal choice. You know, I get that, but when your personal choice, you know, like you say, you know, does have severe consequences on the rest of society, then that's just not on law, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, that's why. So that's where we perhaps say the state can come in. So, for instance, drunk driving. I mean, if you only killed yourself or
right.
maimed yourself, it'd probably be okay.
I mean, as tragic as that sounds, but you know.
Yeah, but you know, the chances of you also actually hurting somebody else is so high that's when you know your personal freedom meets with the greater good, and there is a border there. Speaking of borders, a very interesting news. The Malaysian passport is now the fourth most powerful out of 199 countries. And before we start yelling Malaysia Boleh, this global study...
Way to be a wet blanket there, buddy.
We actually share that honour with several other countries, seven other countries. In fact, Australia, Belgium, Japan, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, Portugal and Switzerland. And the reason is we provide visa-free access to 156 countries.
Nice.
So, whoopee for us.
There's a but.
The but is that our southern neighbor, Singapore, along with Germany, outranks us. They are, in fact, the most powerful passport in the world.
Sharaj.
And they have access to, visa-free access to 159 countries. That's three countries more.
Sharad, not everything has to be a competition. Okay?
With Singapore.
Exactly. I know because of your roots, you know, you're always looking, you know, over the causeway and wondering shoulda, coulda, woulda.
No, it's also, I mean, we have a love-hate relationship with Singapore, I think. No, because we were one country before and I think but, you know, the truth is, it is. And I know that the Malaysian passport is powerful.
Yeah, it's
because,
great.
You know, when you travel, you see that there's very little suspicion about the passport, and it's wonderful not to have to get into kind of a visa, application process. It's always, first of all, it just makes things much cheaper. And the other hand, of course, it also makes things much more efficient.
Right. And also, the process, I mean, I must say this, you know, because when I came back into the country a few years ago and I had to renew my passport again, you know, the process of just renewing your passport was just so efficient as well. I think I got it done in like under 2 hours.
You know?
I dropped it off at the counter, went off, had my breakfast, came back, done. Ta-da!
You know, you're too young to remember the dark old days of long queues, really inefficient bureaucracy when it came to passports. And
I've heard stories.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, your grandpapa told you. Not necessarily about the dark old days. Okay, a related story is talking about, you know, the lands that we want to go to. New Zealand, Australia, of course, destination for a number of Malaysians over the decades. They're introducing stricter rules on working visas. And in fact, with New Zealand in particular, they're trying to raise the quality of immigrants. I'm wondering, what do we mean by the quality of an immigrant?
Well, okay, I'm speaking here based on my experience. And I did have a work holiday visa in Australia and New Zealand, not to go...
and yet you came home.
Yeah, and that is very true. And that's a very good point. And I wish I had time to go into why. But, you know, essentially, when you look at these immigrant labor, so to speak, you know, the local populace, generally speaking, has a somewhat skewed perspective. You know, they view them as low skilled, and you know, they're undercutting the pays of, you know, domestic employees, right? So there is this negative connotation, and it's interesting to see that these kind of comments have now gone up all the way to the top level of the New Zealand government, and they're making comments like that. Now, on one hand, I understand, you know, if you are coming approaching this from a protectionist standpoint, you know, you do want to make sure that the wages of your people are taken care of. And I get that, but at the same time, you know, look, I always say, you know, it takes two to tango, and there have been what
wonderful. You always said it, and nobody else had ever thought of this.
Okay, fine. Yeah, I know it's a cliche. Fine. Oh, gosh. Anyways, the point being, there are certain prejudices that I have personally witnessed on the part of our New Zealand and Australian employees as well.
You know, the other thing, of course, is that I think of immigrants as a long-term commitment to diversity and inclusiveness. And even if that particular immigrant comes in and does a job that doesn't require them to have a PhD, their children, if we enable it, could be a huge asset to us. And we see that in countries that have these policies of inviting people in. You know, and, you know, I think of the U.S. in particular. So the first generation might be, you know, working in not in the plantations, but working in, say, a fruit orchard. But their children then go flourish, and you have so many success stories. You know, think of Ralph Nader or Steve Jobs. You know, I mean, all of them children of people who came from different parts of the world and did so well in America. But we'll come back to that, the first bulletin of the day, up next, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run, and that was Out of Control by U2. Sorry. Was my... Did I say something funny?
Well, just the way you said it, you know, like... You sound like an aspiring, you know, top DJ, 40 DJ, you know, from the 80s and 90s.
Somebody hire me. I want to be a DJ. I'm sure I'd cut in, of course. And it's just after 40 minutes past 6 o'clock. And time to talk about travel. We were talking about travel earlier. Mm-hmm. And then because we go to these exotic places, sometimes just for a holiday, but sometimes to relocate. And we have to adapt to those local conditions. And sometimes it impinges on things that are deeply personal, like your name.
That's right. So you've got this story here it's actually the other way around, where a Chinese billionaire, a billionaire from China, is actually moving not to a less exotic place called the States. I mean, would you consider the States exotic?
Yeah, some places are, I think.
Yeah, some corners, I guess, maybe. But this Chinese billionaire, so when he went into the American market, now he wanted, he's part of the Great Wall Motors, so they sell a lot more SUVs there. His name is Wei Jianjun. All right, Wei Jianjun.
Okay.
But as he goes about trying to, you know, penetrate the already highly competitive SUV market in the States, he's having to rebrand himself, and I'm using air quotes here, rebrand himself and give himself a new name, that being Jack Wei. And, you know,
Jack Wei?
Yeah, Jack Wei.
Like, so, Jack Ma?
Yeah, but Wei instead of Ma, right. And also he had to change the spelling because in Chinese, Wei is spelled W-E-I, where else, or at least in Hanyi Pinyin, I would assume. But with the American one, it's W-E-Y, you know, so Jack Wei. So I think the idea here is this, because I kind of had a similar experience, but not to that extent.
Because you're not a billionaire.
Well, yeah, I'm not a billionaire. For I'm not starters. Selling SUVs, yes. Although, aspiring billionaire, just like you are an aspiring top 40 DJ. You know, so I think the idea is this, you know, whether, are we at risk of, you know, losing all this, you know, rich cultural heritage and, you know, our respective identities that are so evident all over the world? And, you know, in the name of, you know, globalization, on just being familiar with the locals, you know, what do you think?
Well, on one hand, I think there's a deep pragmatism, and most immigrant cultures are pragmatic. They want to keep something of themselves, but they know because they have moved, they have to adapt to their new situations. And in fact, adaptation is the name of the game. It's always happened. I mean, you know, Jack Wei is coming into America. But when you think about what is American, except this strange and wonderful amalgam of European cultures, native cultures, and, you know, and other kinds of imports, people from the African continent, then that is American, and there's accommodation all throughout in that those, you know, hundreds of years of peopling of North America. So I, you know, it's just a continual process. There's nothing particularly new. Or I think in some sense disturbing about it.
While I can certainly see the rationale, you know, for the pragmatic, you know, reasons for such a move, but I wonder, you know, at the same time, why is it that the adapting has to be on the part of the immigrant, and why is it that the host country, you know, cannot adapt? You know, like, look, I mean, immigration into America is not something new. It's like, you know, it's about time they got used to Wei Jianjun.
Okay, so there's this issue of, you know, what is the dominant culture, and when minorities come into a dominant culture, just the sheer fact that they're the dominant. But it doesn't always work that way, and you see in history different kinds of changes. When you think of the Mongol hordes, as it were, that invaded China, they in fact became sinicized. So they were the powerful and brokers of power, but Chinese culture was so attractive to them that they eventually became sinified. They became Chinese, you know. So Genghis Khan, and then of course down the line to Kublai Khan. By the time he got to Kublai Khan, he was indistinguishable, I think. I mean, I'm not an expert in Chinese history, but I think he became Chinese. And so the story of adaptation, yes, you're right, it doesn't need to work one way. But I think in this instance, you know, Jack Wei is just maybe reaching for something that is easy. because he's a businessman and he wants to sell something.
Right, you know, so once again, the pragmatic element to it, I get him because he's got the motive of just trying to sell SUVs. It's not like he's really going through an identity crisis of sorts. You could almost see this name change as a marketing ploy. And in fact, it was actually recommended by a brand or a PR agency for the name change and, creating this premium nameplate of Way, just so they can sell more SUVs. But, I get your side of the argument, but you would think that, civilization has, matured enough where we can start accommodating more, different cultures and, different nuances. There's so many nuances out there, as opposed to resorting to just Jack.
Okay, so then there is that whole movement, and I think that you see this in many countries, called multiculturalism. And this is when the dominant culture says, okay, we don't want to destroy your culture. You don't have to be exactly like us. And in fact, we're going to find ways of accommodating you and recognizing your culture. And so that explicit policy of inclusivity is there in some countries. I mean, it's being tested in many ways, especially in Europe and Britain and those countries that, kind of saw themselves as the standard bearers for multiculturalism. They see the problems of that, and they also perhaps in some parts of their population resent the fact that people who come to their countries don't want to adapt, want to hold themselves back, want to be, so they want to be accepted on one hand, but they want to also create a sort of cordon sanitaire or these walls around themselves in order that they, they don't have to deal with the local culture and demands. And so there's that dynamic too, right? And, and I think there's a strange sweet spot between these two types of movements or, processes.
Yeah, but at the same time, when you see the global trends that we have, this rise in protectionism, this rather xenophobic behavior that's being evidenced, at the government level, you look at what the outpouring of sentiment during the Brexit, vote, you see in the campaign trail for Donald Trump, the kind of statements that were made, mainly by his supporters, right? And then it almost puts to risk this whole idea of globalization and inclusivity, So, and then when you see these kind of headlines where even Chinese billionaires, prominent businessmen are not spared, from this tidal wave of just ethnocentric behavior, I think that's the key, right? You would think that this ethnocentric worldview has pretty much been made obsolete, but I guess not.
Well, not. I mean, you can either take a view that cultures develop in a kind of linear fashion. They're just going forward, never looking back. Or you might think of cultures that developing like in a pendulum swing. So they swing towards one end and then the other. In this case, maybe being tolerant and inclusive to being intolerant and exclusivist, right? So, maybe we're on that part of the pendulum swing where you can see that in Europe and you can see that in America, and you see that in different parts of Asia as well, this really tightening up of identity against maybe a former state of being open.
And I think we were having this discussion during the break as well, right, where I believe your family also went through this assimilation process.
Of course, I'm a third generation Malaysian. My father decided to change his name in this regard. He wanted to create a surname. So for him, that wasn't so much the dominant culture, but the dominant culture in that instance was Western culture, modern culture. So he thought a surname was necessary. So he gave us his father's name and tried to make it a surname. And the fact that my brother, who's had two kids now, he's given that same surname. Otherwise, in the tradition of naming him from my family, I would have been Sharad, son of my father, in this case Chittaranjan, but I became Sharad Kutan. The other thing that my father did, because we lived in Singapore, was he changed the pronunciation of his father's name. It's Kutan, not Kutan, though it's spelt like Kutan, and that's how my father would say it. He always said Kutan. Right. And this was accommodating to the ease with which other people, mostly Chinese Singaporeans, had with his name.
Right, and I guess for my side of the story, it is somewhat of a minor sore point, for my time in the States, because my name is Tan Chung Han, but obviously to fit that into the first name, last name basis when I was in Australia and the States, I had to then change it around. Well, I wasn't going to go and, adopt a Jack or Sam or Billy, right?
You became Chung Han Tan?
No, so it became Han Tan Tan. Well, and I know it rhymes and it's a name that no one's going to forget anytime soon. But obviously, you know, sometimes, you know, when I mentioned that.
What happened
to Chung? Like, is Chung my middle name or my first name? And I don't know, right? Because I go by Han, so, that's my first name. And fortunately or unfortunately, it rhymes with my surname. So I went with Han Tan for, like, those, you know, 10 years or so that I was
abroad.
So
does it make it easy for people? Were you, like, the most popular kid in high school?
Well, I was certainly remember. And it was a good thing, you know, fortunately, my personality, you know, and endeared many a people to me, so beyond my name. But, you know, there were some awkward moments at the start of each semester when I had professors trying to figure out, is Han Tan here? Han Tan? Every semester, you know, I got that. So it was a bit of a frustration, but, you know, all in all,
but
it wasn't such a big deal.
Do you ever have trouble, pronouncing a Polish name, for instance? Oh, I do.
Right, yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of European names I struggle to say properly, and I often have to kind of go to Forvo or ask the person, how do I say your name?
Man, you struggle mentioning my name every single day for the last 3 months.
No, that's just because my tongue's not in gear. 6 a.m. Okay, we're coming up to the news. But first, here's Twisting by the Pool by Dire Straits, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.